Drive Time Live with Mills Crenshaw.
We're back. Martin Tanner sitting in for Mills Crenshaw, who is out of town today at a martial arts extravaganza in Las Vegas. If you are just tuning in, we have with us two wonderful guests. We have John Lynch, who's the chairman of FAIR, which is an LDS apologetics organization. And in studio, he's with us by phone from California, and we have in studio Stephen Smoot, who is also with FAIR. If you have questions or comments for them, they'll be with us during this next hour as well. You're welcome to give us a call from Salt Lake County. The number is 801-570-5855. If you'd like to join us from Utah County, it's 801-470-5855. And from North Davis and Weber County, it's 670-5855. Now, let's go back to our caller, who I hope is still waiting over the break. Are you there, caller?
I sure am.
Thank you for waiting. Go right ahead.
Oh, no, I was hoping your guest would answer the question about the four different versions of the...
Mark Knoller.
Go ahead. About the four different versions of the first vision, I assume you're going to say.
Yes.
I think they're actually more like six first-hand accounts, and depending on how you count them up, as many as eight different accounts of the first vision. And I'm not sure where you're going with that, caller. Are you bringing up the idea that they all have slightly different ways that they describe it?
Yes, and the comment I want to make, I would, if it were me, of course, this is just my thought, being a humble little follower. But if God showed up to me, or a heavenly messenger from God showed up to me, I would never forget that, and it wouldn't ever change.
Well, let me ask you this. What's the most important day in your life? Did you get married?
Well, I think probably the most important was the birthday, but I don't
know. Well, pick your most important birthday and write it out today. And then in 1 month, write it out again what happened on that day, and then pick another month and four different months, and I'll bet not one of those four would be exactly the same.
Well, I can counter that if I may.
Sure.
In 1968 in Vietnam, I near met my death, and as that was transpiring, a voice came to me and it says, "You know better than this. Get away." I walked 20 feet away, and there was an explosion. Knocked out 15 guys of the 16 of us that were there. I don't forget that. I don't forget the words I used.
Okay.
So I would disagree with you.
Well, so you would describe the same event the same way to a 10-year-old and maybe to a war vet and to your wife. It would never change at all.
No. And if you're telling me that those four visions, one of them was for a group of adolescents, that's fine. I can understand that.
One of them was to a newspaper editor for general consumption. Others were for different audiences and in different contexts and at different points in his life. And I for one, would be shocked if they were all exactly the same.
And from the way you've described it, hey, I go along with that, but that's not the way it was, because the first time he said it was an angel, then the next time was God, and blah, blah, blah. And there were extraordinary difference in the whole context of it.
I disagree with you. Have read in detail every single one of those, and I don't see them as contradictory. I see them as complementary. John, okay. you had a comment here.
Well, I was actually my comment was more along the lines of what the first vision meant for Joseph Smith more than anything. You know, we have to for those of us who are, you know, converts to the church or people who have heard this as a narrative, explaining the start of what we call the Restoration. We oftentimes forget that Joseph Smith didn't go into those woods with the expectation of starting a new religious movement. He went into those woods with a very specific objective in mind, and that was for him to learn for himself what he should do. And so when he went into those woods, he had a profoundly personal experience. What's more perplexing for me than the fact that he had variations in how he related the story is the fact that he didn't publish it very early on in the church. I mean, it wasn't until the 1830s we got our first publications. So what you actually have here is you have Joseph Smith putting forth a publication about something that was, for all intents and purposes, deeply personal, highly, highly, highly spiritual for him. And it wasn't something, I think, that he was looking to use as a proof or evidence of the Restoration. Quite to the contrary, it was a personal communication for him. It was then, and then I also agree with what you're saying, Martin, that when you start to look at the explanations that he gave, they were to different audiences. I think that in some ways he was probably trying to couch some of the sacred nature of the experience. He wasn't trying to speak directly. I think he may have even been fearful of how characterizing it for what it really was would have been received. And it wasn't until he matured and gained greater confidence in the experience itself that he began to speak more boldly about the events as they really happened and that sort of thing. But for me, you know, I look at the first vision really as a profoundly personal spiritual experience that Joseph Smith had. And I can tell you right now, as a convert of the church, I've had my own personal spiritual endeavors with God. And depending on who I'm talking to and the receptive nature of them as an audience, I absolutely do tailor it. I do describe things differently to one group than I do to another.
Absolutely. I'll give you one other analogy. I've spoken for years with different people who have had what are now termed near-death experiences. And some of the people that I know that have had these kinds of experiences in connection with accidents or whatever had them a long time ago, when they were not readily accepted, and they were reluctant to say anything about them at all. And if they did, they just say, yeah, I had this experience and I left my physical body. And then later, when they started to become a little bit more accepted, they would describe more about what happened when they left, like maybe they saw family members on the other side, but they would only tell this to people that they knew and trusted. And then perhaps later on, they would give the complete story, like they saw God or had a life's review or were told to do certain things. And so the kind of thing that happened with Joseph Smith, to me, because of my experience with interviews with people who've had near-death experiences, seems completely natural and not one bit out of the ordinary. As a matter of fact, it seems the logical way that it would develop. I might look askance at Joseph Smith for, you know, out of nowhere coming up with this great big huge long elaborate description of absolutely everything that happened within a year or two after the event itself.
Yeah, just if I could add just one or two points here. There's a quote by Hugh Nibley that I feel is very appropriate on this subject. So Fawn Brody, as some of your listeners may know, was one of Joseph Smith's biographers. She was very critical of Joseph Smith, and she alleged that Joseph Smith made up the first vision to bolster his credibility in later years. And her evidence for this, her argument from silence, as it literally was that he never talked about it before 18 whenever, and she gave some date that later turned out to be wrong, but she gives his date. And Hugh Nibley responded by saying, you know, there are some things that you don't run to the press talking about. And one of them are spiritual experiences of this magnitude. Joseph Smith himself explicitly says in the history of the church, the reason why he's publishing this is because there's been so much inaccuracy in the press about the church. He says, I was constrained or compelled to publish this. We know what happened when he tried to tell somebody initially, this minister. He was rebuked for it, and he was immediately disbelieved. So I think it's absolutely plausible that Joseph Smith only revealed the first vision to others when he felt it was appropriate, as you were saying, Martin, you know, when it would have been more accepted. The other thing I'd also like to just mention briefly is the claim that there are these wild contradictions in the different accounts, I don't think could be substantiated. I think there's some misunderstanding on the part of the caller when he says that one version says there's just an angel and one others. I think he may be misunderstanding what documents he's reading or what he is reading. The documents have been published. They're open to everybody who wants to read them, and they'll see that the contradictions, quote-unquote contradictions, really aren't that grave or serious or fatal as perhaps critics have tried to say.
That is very true. One of the other points to make here is that if you happen to be a believing Christian and you open the book of Luke, it starts off with saying, in effect, and of course this is a paraphrase, gee, there are all these other many accounts of what happened, and I've kind of checked into them, and now I'm going to tell you the real account after having talked to a bunch of eyewitnesses. And so you have Luke saying there are all these different varied accounts of Christ and his life, and he was going to try to write the definitive account. And that doesn't mean that the prior accounts, you know, Matthew or Mark, were bogus or somehow wrong in the ways that they differed. It was a different audience. It was done for a different purpose. And his particular letter was to a Roman official named Theophilus. And so just like Joseph Smith and the way he described his first vision to different people, you have the New Testament narratives of Christ's life in the form of the Gospels written very differently.
Yeah, speaking of Luke, Martin, by the way, we see a direct parallel with how Luke describes Paul's first vision in the book of Acts. Luke gives three different accounts of Paul's vision in the book of Acts. And in each one of them, we see the same phenomenon where he gives different details of what Paul experienced, sometimes even quoting Paul as saying it, and you can see within each context why he gave those details. In one context, Paul is talking to a group of Jewish leaders, so it wouldn't be very wise for Paul to say, oh, and by the way, Jesus also said I have to go preach the gospel to the Gentiles. That would have been a death sentence for Paul. And yet, a couple of chapters later, Paul is standing before a Gentile king, Agrippa, and he has to give his defense there. And so what does he do? He says, well, the reason I'm doing this is because Jesus told me to go take the gospel to the Gentiles. Now, a critic could say, aha, Luke is contradicting himself there because he never said that earlier. He didn't say anything about preaching the gospel to the Gentiles earlier. Only in this later account did he do that. But it's not a contradiction. As we've discussed here, it's just different context for different reasons.
It is. John, let's swing back to something that is really timely and really critical, which is the whole issue of politics and Mormonism. We've got Mitt Romney running for the presidency. What are some of the major issues that you think are going to be, and some already have, come out in connection with Romney? The one that comes to mind immediately to me is, oh, we can't elect this guy president because, hey, if the LDS Church leadership tells him to do something, he's going to go do it. He's not going to be doing what's best for the country. He's going to be doing what the church leadership tells him to do.
Yeah, you know, the let me say at the outset, FAIR is, by the way, apolitical. We don't espouse parties, politics, platforms, or otherwise. We defend the church. Having said that, in as much as we've got someone such as Mitt Romney that is really seeking such a high office, it brings a lot of scrutiny, and so these issues come up. What some of the issues are obviously stem from the political discussions that you find in the news media today. I mean, you had the Arizona law that was recently dismantled in large part by the Supreme Court for illegal immigration and the efforts that they were having to try and basically combat what they saw was a necessity. That's one of the issues. Mitt Romney has a particular position on that, and that brings scrutiny onto things because he happens to be Mormon. Now, oddly enough, Mitt Romney has an opposing opinion to the LDS Church. Or it could be interpreted that way. Mitt Romney's position is...
John, hold on for just a minute. For some reason, when you talk, the brakes come. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. John Lynch, finish that thought then. Thanks.
AM 630 K-Talk, the voice of Utah. Drive Time Live with Mills Crenshaw.
This is the Mills Crenshaw Show. Martin Tanner sitting in for the Vacationing Mills. We have as guest today John Lynch, who's the chairman of FAIR, with us by phone. And we also have Stephen Smoot, who's with us in studio. And I apologize again, John. It seems like every time you're in the middle of a thought, we have a commercial break. But you're welcome to continue your thought.
Oh, no problem. You got to pay the bills. No offense.
That we do.
So, yeah, your question was around the idea of Mitt Romney's bid for the presidency and the impact, and what are some of the issues that come out of that. And you raised one issue, which was the question of, the freedom that Mitt Romney might experience relative to decisions as a commander-in-chief and otherwise. And, one of the things I was pointing out was the fact that Mitt Romney, for example, has an opposing position to the church relative to, or it could be interpreted that way, relative to issues of immigration. That's in the news as of late because of the recent Supreme Court decision striking down key elements of the Arizona law. You have an example there already where he is not in lockstep with the LDS Church, which takes a much more compassionate view. The LDS Church has a number of converts that are undoubtedly undocumented citizens, and of course the church takes a position that we should be very careful about what we do in terms of splitting up families as we seek the adherence of law and that sort of thing. But Mitt Romney doesn't follow that. If you want a better example, if you could even possibly have set this up, and planned it this way, you've got one of the highest ranking officials in government today. It happens to be a Democrat who is LDS, and he has taken a number of, Harry Reid, he's taken a number of issues which are contrary to the positions that the church relative to the Defense of Marriage Act and gay marriage and things like that. So there are a whole host of issues that could come out of this because of the church's moral stand on certain issues. And you have evidence from both sides of the party of the aisle in U.S. politics where really there's been no evidence that there is a total line requirement from the church or that there's some kind of undue influence.
Yeah, for a minute there, John, I thought you were going to say that Harry Reid took positions that were contrary to common sense, but you just said the church. So I apologize there. If you get directly to Mitt Romney, he has also said personally that he will do what he believes is right for the country, and he will not directly answer the church. Frankly, the church isn't going to tell him what to do anyway, even though there are probably people who don't believe that. He is not going to be somehow directed by the church.
Well, it's an issue of confidence, really, in terms of the history and interactions of going back through time as to how the church itself has acted. A lot of people don't realize that the original problem that the church had in the early days of Utah was that everyone was Democratic. And what has happened has been that there has been a very systematic move towards the Republican Party because of the alignment of a number of issues. And it just happens to be that Mitt Romney follows that. But political party and partisanship, it's really irrelevant to the church's aim and goal. So the church is not interested in commanding politics, in having a voice, except in having a voice to the general public on moral issues, such as the position it took with Proposition 8 and some others.
That's absolutely right. Some very prominent church leaders were affiliated with the Democratic Party, Bruce R. McConkie, Hugh B. Brown, and President David O. McKay, for just a few that we could name, were affiliated with the Democratic Party. Of course, there are others who swung to the right far more when you look at someone like Ezra Taft Benson, for example.
Yeah, and I think that it's because of the very visible position that Ezra Taft Benson took as Secretary of Agriculture that in the Eisenhower administration that lends people, and his vocal comments at the time relative to communism that kind of lends itself to the perception that there is a party line within the church. There's not. But more to your issue, which was the issue of being controlled or influenced, you know, that's the red flag about Mormonism. But, you know, there's a lot of good reasons why Mormons are disproportionately represented in politics. And I think it has to do with work ethic, the values that are instilled in members of the church because of the things that they are taught on a weekly basis. There is the willingness to step out of comfort zones because of the historic practice of participating in missionary endeavors and that sort of thing. So there are a number of really good qualities that people should feel good about, that a Mormon is involved in politics, regardless of what political party they happen to belong to.
What are some other issues other than just the one that we've talked about, because there are many, many more that we could discuss about Mitt Romney and politics and whether or not it should or should not be an issue. I heard one recently about, of course, gosh, the church, nobody should vote for Mitt Romney because he belongs to a racist organization. I don't know how many different times I've heard that in one context or another in connection with his campaign, but I don't see that to be true.
Well, you know, the issues of race relations are very sensitive, and rightfully so. Nobody wants to be told that they're a lesser person, and nobody should be told they're a lesser person. Gordon B. Hinckley made a comment in a priesthood session of General Conference where he, I'm paraphrasing, he basically said that anybody that thinks that another person is unworthy of receiving the priesthood based solely on their race are themselves not worthy of the priesthood. And you know, that basically goes to illustrate where the church's position is today. There clearly was a period of time where the priesthood was based on policy, stemming from the days of Brigham Young, where the priesthood was withheld from those of African descent. And the practice, we don't know why it came about. There really is no historic record that we can point to that says this is why it happened. What we do know is that there have been a lot of attempts to explain it, and they have, for the most part, been horribly wrong. Bruce R. McConkie, you point out, even himself, came back, and after he was present when President Kimball announced to the Quorum of the Twelve that the practice of withholding the priesthood from those of African descent would be discontinued, and he voted in favor of it. And he even, in Mormon doctrine, said that it was not going to happen in our lifetime, and he came back to his credit immediately afterward and said, forget everything I said on the subject. We now live under the light of a new day, basically, and you know, it's time to move on. What we really need in race relations today, in my personal opinion, is we need to move past you know, harping on any of the mistakes of the past, and we need to look forward. I don't think that the LDS Church, even with the priesthood ban, fared all that poorly in terms of practice. We never had segregated congregations, ever. Joseph Smith himself ordained black men to the priesthood. Joseph Smith was assassinated, some people believe, specifically because he was campaigning for president on the platform of giving blacks their freedom through sale of public lands and taking those monies to buy their freedom. So, you know, it's a really tough thing. It's a very complex subject. It's not easy. There were clearly horribly erroneous explanations that were attempted to explain the ban. But, you know, in terms of the church itself and the views of its members, you know, the church is growing leaps and bounds in Africa right now, and has been since the ban was lifted. And so, you know, our message resonates with people of all races, and I really hope that people can get past this and move on. The church already has; it's moved on for a long time now.
It certainly has. More people who are members of the LDS faith do not speak English as their native language than do at this point in time, which is quite an amazing fact.
That is true.
One of the other questions or issues that I wanted to bring up here in connection with Romney's presidency is the whole issue of patriarchal authority. There are those who say, "Oh gosh, the Mormon faith, you know, it's just a bunch of men, and they just kind of run everything." And yet, well, you know what? I have some strong feelings about that issue, but I'll leave it to you and Stephen to comment here, because I think this is also one of the things that Romney is likely to encounter as a criticism.
Yeah, I think the first thing I'd like to say to anybody who tries to bring up that criticism is I asked them if they've ever heard of the Relief Society of the Church, one of the oldest women's organizations, I believe, in the world, if not in the country. One of the oldest, most still standing women's organizations is the LDS Relief Society. And, you know, I think that you can look at the fact that, you know, the predominant number of our leaders, general authorities, they are male. We do have a patriarchal priesthood. And some people may believe that, oh, therefore, you know, Mormons are sexist, women have a second-class citizenship in the Mormon Church, and so forth. But I think that's misunderstanding the LDS idea of priesthood and the LDS idea of, gender roles, I guess they're often called. I use that term carefully because I know there's some, you know, nuance to that. But the idea is, you know, when we have this eternal perspective of man and woman and what their eternal destinies are, what they can be, I think that it makes more sense and it's more nuanced, the role of women in the church. All the women, and this is just coming from my own personal, you know, interactions with women I know who are in the church, none of them that I know have complained about feeling like they're second class or that they're not as appreciated or that they're somehow lower than men in the church. You know, I'm sure there are women out there who may feel that, but all the women I've met have not voiced that concern. And I believe once you look at it more carefully and more nuanced, you'll see that there's more to it than just Mormon male sexism trying to dominate the church.
John Lynch, your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, we're going to address this topic at least in part with Nayland's remarks at our upcoming conference. She's going to present her own view and theory on this. Of course, she's deeply meshed, immersed in conversations with LDS women, which is really where we need to turn and see how is this impacting. From the outside world, you know, I can easily see where, you know, someone looking at the LDS Church could have a concern relative to, you know, what the gender relationships are within the church. But I think Stephen brings up a tremendous point, which is that realistically, what it means in secular society versus what it means to the LDS to hold the priesthood, for example, is it's not typically what you would think. Mormons have very much the servant mentality. You know, we don't have a priesthood that is paid. I think there's probably a lot of men that would just as soon have the women, you know, volunteer and run things, you know, to be perfectly honest. And that's in some ways a condemnation of the men that are involved. But, you know, there's another dynamic here, which is that I think a lot of times men, and somewhat to their credit and somewhat to their fault, overly revere women. They put them on pedestals that they themselves can't reach. But what is really unique about Mormon doctrine, if I can use that term, and I don't mean it in the Bruce R. McConkie sense, but the LDS belief that we can become like our heavenly parents means that we have to have a tight relationship with our spouse. We cannot achieve all that Heavenly Father intends for us without that cooperative relationship with our spouse, and it creates a dependency and not a separation, at least for us.
Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air. Your first name, please.
Hi, this is John.
Go ahead, John.
Hey, I'm calling from Harriman. Are you guys still talking about the women's rights within the LDS Church? Like Romney and...
You're welcome to bring up that topic. That's okay. Exactly what we're discussing, yes.
Well, I am I joined the church a little over 3 years ago, and I moved to Utah 2 years ago from Tennessee, and we had this exact discussion in our priesthood quorum this past Sunday, and the lesson was on a talk by Sister Beck from the last conference about the role of Relief Society, and I raised a comment that our instructor said pretty much summed up the lesson in whole, because we were talking about how the priesthood quorum sustained the women, and the Relief Society sustains the others. The bishop can't do all the work within the ward, and, you know, it trickles on down. And I said they are symbiotic relationships, and I likened it to working out. That, you know, we can't work your function without incorporating multiple muscles. The bicep can't do the quadricep, so on. The world outside would realize that and looked at it, they would see that every part of our church, every individual of our church, functions as a whole. I believe priesthood blessings trickle down through the ladies, maybe more so than what I'm able to do as an ordained elder, because I feel that the women are more sensitive, and their faith, I think, drives us to do things that we aren't naturally inclined to do. And I think that if the world was open to that and saw it, I think that they would be a lot less skeptical of Mr. Romney as a candidate.
Well, I think you bring up a really good point, caller. One of the main differences between the LDS position about men and women is that they both have very important roles, but the roles are different. The world as a whole tries to push towards absolute equality, and the church pushes towards different roles that are very, very important. One of the fascinating things to me is that it's finally happened. I am talking, and time for me to stop. We'll come back. More from the Mills Crenshaw Show, Drive Time Live, right on the other side of this break. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with John Lynch and Stephen Smoot from FAIR.
AM 630 K-Talk, live local two-way talk. Drive Time Live with Mills Crenshaw.
We're back. This is Drive Time Live, the Mills Crenshaw Show. Martin Tanner in for Mills Crenshaw. If you're just joining us, we have two representatives from FAIR, which is a Mormon apologetics group that just does wonderful work. And in just a minute, we'll tell you again about their upcoming conference. The point that I was going to make when our break occurred is that the LDS Church traditionally has been seen as an extremely open organization. The very first state was to give women the right to vote was Utah, and the very next state to vote to give women the right to vote, women's suffrage, was Wyoming. And both of those, of course, were because of the influence of the LDS faith. Susan B. Anthony and other women's rights advocates were coming out to Utah to visit with the LDS Relief Society to find out how they convinced all the men here to give them so much power and authority and influence in Utah. It's something that was seen as very forward-thinking and unheard of at the time, and yet now, sadly, the church is seen by many as a patriarchal organization. Anyway, I'll kind of leave it there. Caller, your first name, and tell us your question or comment. Hello?
Tom?
Yes,
hello?
You're on the air.
Oh, great. This is Tom.
Hi, Tom.
And my comment to you is, opposed to apologizing for the religion itself, I think I would pose the question to the general public that has a problem with it: was Kennedy a good president? And when they say yes, because I think most people like Kennedy, ask them the last time they heard about a woman pope, or a woman pope, or a woman Catholic bishop, or a woman Catholic priest. They don't frickin' exist. They're as patriarchal as the Mormons are, and that did not change whether or not Kennedy turned out to be a decent president. So why apologize for what it is? Just deal with it.
There you go. Great, great comment. Thank you for that.
Yeah, and by the way, I think we just need to put out another statement here that apologetics doesn't mean saying you're sorry, not apologizing. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. It's defending as opposed to apologizing.
Absolutely. We have just about 15 minutes left in the show here. Actually, not even quite that. Let's tell everybody about our conference that's coming up again tell them again about the conference that's coming up for FAIR in August.
Yeah, so we've got coming up on the 2nd and 3rd of August. That's a Friday and Saturday, starting at about 8 a.m. each day and closing right around 5. We've got a series of presenters. It'll be held at the Southtown Expo, and they will be addressing topics that are relevant today pertaining to criticisms of the LDS Church. And they will stem across the gambit from issues that are being raised because of the political aspirations of some of our members to issues that have been, longstanding criticisms.
If somebody wants to attend the conference, is there some certain category only that are allowed, or can anybody go?
No, it's open to anybody. We have critics. We've had people that, the only thing we ask is that when you come that you be respectful and you not disrupt the proceedings. But anybody's allowed to come, and everyone's encouraged. There is a cost associated because we're a nonprofit organization, so the cost really covers just our expenses to hold the event. It's $80 for 2 days, and I think it's $50 for a single day's worth of sessions. That includes meals. If you don't get food, it's a little bit cheaper, but everybody's welcome.
And how can somebody sign up if they want to do that?
Just go to www.fairlds.org. On the main page there's a link right in the center of the page for our FAIR conference, and you can go there and you can sign up and purchase tickets.
It's a great conference each year, and some of the subjects are fantastic. They're dealing with everything from the whole issue of DNA in the Book of Mormon to religious freedom to blacks within the LDS faith. All kinds of different things are coming up. It'll be a wonderful, wonderful event.
The other thing I'll briefly add is if you're not able to catch the conference as it's happening in Sandy, we try to get the transcripts of the presentations up as soon as possible. We also film it, and we usually make the videos available as soon as possible. So there's multiple ways in which you can attend the conference or read what's going on. If you want to sort of get an idea of what the conference is like, what the presentations are like, if you go onto FAIR's YouTube channel, which I believe you just type in FAIR LDS into the search engine there, it'll bring up the FAIR YouTube channel. We have many broadcasts or videos of previous FAIR conference presentations, and so that should give those not familiar with the conference sort of an idea or an understanding of what the conference is like, what the presentations are like, what sort of the caliber is or what level they're at. And then, of course, check it out afterwards to get that information if you've missed it.
And John Lynch, chairman of FAIR, tell our listeners who may not know too much about FAIR exactly what the organization is all about and what they could find if they were to visit fairlds.org on the Internet.
Sure. We are an all-volunteer group, a nonprofit organization staffed by faithful members of the LDS Church who give up their time and talent on top of church callings and family and job responsibilities in order to help people who are struggling with questions of criticisms against the church. Everything that we do is from a faithful perspective. We try and give faithful answers to whatever criticism might be ailing somebody. And so we have a number of properties that can be accessed through our website. We've got a what we call our FAIR Wiki, which is accessible from the left-hand side of the main page there, that has over 4,000 criticisms of the LDS Church and an analysis and answer and further reading for those criticisms. We've got blacklds.org. We've got Mormon Voices if you'd like to know how you can get involved in a number of the discussions where the LDS Church is being bantied about and you'd like to chime in with your voice as a faithful LDS member. You can sign up for Mormon Voices and get notices on where there's hot spots on the Internet where these things are happening. We also have a website called Mormon Scholars Testify, which puts to bed the notion that once you become intelligent, you abandon religion. Mormon scholars are, in fact, it tends to be the other way. The more educated Mormons are, the more faithful they tend to be. So we've got lots of properties, lots of different resources that people can turn to. We've also got a service called Ask the Apologist. If you've got a question, something that's been bugging you, you just don't have an answer, you can write into us, and we've got access to experts around the globe who can chime in and help and help you find the answers that you're looking for.
We have another caller with a question or comment. Your first name, please.
Lynette.
Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you.
Your question or comment for our guest, please.
Okay. I don't have computer access, so I don't know if you have a phone. I don't know if you have a phone number. But also, when I was down, I went to your there at one time. Was it last year? I don't remember. And you had also a place where you could buy books and material on your...
Okay, great question. If somebody doesn't have computer access, how would they sign up for the conference and tell our caller about your books that are available online and just through fair generally at the conference?
Well, you know what? I've never encountered the problem where I didn't, or I had somebody that didn't have internet access. So we'll have to address that. We'll have to get a phone number that she can call. But if she leaves her number with your producer, rather than hanging up, if she calls back, I'll be happy to leave my number. She can give me a call, and we'll make arrangements.
I also believe. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, John.
Oh, I was just going to say that from the bookstore standpoint, we boast one of the largest online bookstores of scholarly LDS publications that you'll find anywhere on the internet. And so, yes, the bookstore is there. It's accessible also from our main website, and we encourage people to go to it. It's one of the only resources that we have other than generous donations for us to get the operating funds that we need.
I also believe there's walk-in registration at the conference, if I'm not mistaken. So if you can't sign up online, you can still show up on the day of the conference and pay there for a registration. And insofar as being able to access fair publications, of course we are predominantly...
Before you go on to that next point,
oh, sure.
If somebody wants to show up on August 2nd or 3rd at the Southtown Expo Center in Sandy, what time do you start? Anyone know the answer to that, John? Or
registration starts at 8 a.m. The first presentation is at 9 a.m. On Thursday,
so,
and on Friday the first we start registration at 8:30, and the first presentation is also at 9.
Okay, so if you show up between 8 and 9 on the second or the third caller, you'll be able to enjoy whatever you'd like to enjoy there and show up for the whole thing.
I was also just going to mention briefly. Most of our material is online on our website, but FAIR, a couple of years ago, did publish a book entitled Shaken Faith Syndrome, Strengthening One's Testimony in the Face of Criticism and Doubt. And I believe it sold at Deseret Book and other local LDS bookstores in the Salt Lake, Utah area. And that will give you a really good example or sample of the sort of material that you could find on our website. A lot of the material that Michael Ash, the author of the book, a lot of the material in his book he pulled from stuff from FAIR that he had previously written or others that had written from FAIR. And so for those without internet access, you can pick up that book. I think it's relatively cheap, and that'll give you an understanding of what FAIR is all about.
Caller, thank you for joining us. That was a great... Great question. In our few minutes remaining here, gentlemen, why don't you tell our listeners a bit more about what, or who, rather, comprises FAIR, because it's far more than just the two of you, although without the two of you, FAIR would not be nearly what it is today, and I mean that in all seriousness, but there are a lot of people who are involved with FAIR, and I think listeners might be fascinated to know a little bit more about the makeup of FAIR and how it governs itself and about perhaps what some of its goals are for the future.
Yeah, FAIR is run by a board of directors. There's four of us on the board. We have one person, Julie Reynolds, who is a online enthusiast, is probably the best way to put it. She's got a lot of acumen of her own rights relative to church history and other things. We've got Kevin Barney, who is a prolific writer and an expert on a number of topics. We have Dan Peterson, one of the early participants with the Maxwell Institute, or FARMS, the Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies. And then there's myself. And then we have a management team. Everybody's volunteer. Nobody gets paid, with the exception of a bookstore employee who, you know, we have to pay them because they're on demand, and we kind of rely on them. So it's kind of an outsourced service that we pay them for. But it's all volunteer. And we draw on the expertise of, we have about 150 volunteers who help us write articles, draft, give input. We have some people who participate actively in our, we have an email group that we communicate, that we use as communication. We're international. We are in multiple countries. We hold conferences sometimes in Europe. We've held conferences in Canada, Germany, the UK. We're considering conferences elsewhere. So, you know, we're a worldwide organization. We're online. We're nonprofit, and we do this out of the, you know, our love for the gospel.
Yeah, there are many, many criticisms directed at the church today from many sources, and so we have many volunteers that can draw from their unique backgrounds to respond to these criticisms. As John mentioned, we have, you know, university professors with PhDs who are members of FAIR, and we also have stay-at-home moms who do this as sort of a hobby. You know, it runs the gamut, and we can draw from that diverse background to answer people's concerns. Somebody may call in with more sort of a practical, down-to-earth sort of situation or problem they may have, and that's where the stay-at-home mom may be able to help more, as opposed to somebody with a very academic question. That's where the university PhD may be able to help. So I mean, if you write into FAIR, you're bound to get a satisfactory answer from a number of different sources tailored to your needs.
Which is a wonderful thing. In our 1 minute that we have left, gentlemen, let me tell you, thank you very much for spending a couple of hours today with us and for telling us a bit more about FAIR and your upcoming conference. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Thank you. And there's the music, so we did that just in time. If anyone would like any more information about the FAIR conference, be in touch. I'll be happy to respond. That's it. Martin Tanner sitting in for Mills Crenshaw. This is Drive Time Live.